seat remained intact. He recovered quickly. "And how wise of Edward to send you to me. I'll do everything I can to help."
"Little Hampton would be ideal," said Simon, "especially while my wife is still working in Paddington."
Charles raised his eyebrows.
"I don't think you've met Elizabeth. She's a doctor at St. Mary's," Simon explained.
"Yes, I can see how convenient Little Hampton would be. Why don't I start by having a word with Alexander Dalgleish, the constituency chairman, and see what I can come up with?"
"That would be extremely helpful."
"Not at all. I'll call him at home this evening and find out what stage they reached over selection, and then I'll put you in the picture."
"I'd appreciate that."
"While I've got you, let me give you the whip for next week," said Charles, passing over a sheet of paper.
Simon folded it up and put it in his pocket.
"I'll call you the moment I have some news."
Simon left feeling happier and a little guilty about his past prejudice concerning Charles, whom he watched disappear into the chamber to carry out his bench duty.
This ends side one of cassette four. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
The European issue had been given 6 days for debate by the backbenchers, the longest period of time allocated to one motion in living memory. Charles strolled down the aisle leading to the front bench and took a seat at the end to check on another set of speeches. Usually he listened intently to see if he could spot a member wavering in his position, but on this occasion his thoughts were in Little Hampton. Andrew Fraser was on his feet, and Charles was delighted to be able to confirm the tick alongside his name before he drifted into deep thought.
"I, for one, shall vote for entry into Europe," Andrew was telling the House. "When my party was in power, I was a pro-European, and now we're in opposition, I can see no good reason to do a volte-face. The principles that held true 2 years ago hold true today. Not all of us..."
Tom Carson leaped up and asked if his honourable friend would give way. Andrew resumed his seat immediately.
"Would my honourable friend really support the peasant farmers of France before the sheep farmers in New Zealand?" asked Carson.
Andrew rose and explained to his colleague that he would certainly expect safeguards for New Zealand, but the initial vote on the floor of the House was on the principle of entry. The details could and should be dealt with in committee. He went on to express the view that had his honourable friend talked of wogs or Jews in such a context, the House would have been in uproar. "Why is it therefore acceptable to the anti-marketeers to describe French farmers as peasants?"
"Perhaps it's you who is the peasant,"
Carson shouted back, in 7 words thus ruining his case for the lamb farmers of New Zealand. Andrew ignored the jibe and went on to tell the House that he believed in a united Europe as a further insurance against a Third World War. He concluded with the words,
"Britain has for 1,000 years written history, even the history of the world. Let us decide with our votes whether our children will read that history or continue to write it."
Andrew sat down to acclamation from both sides. By the time Andrew had resumed his seat, Charles had formed a plan and left the chamber when one of his own colleagues started what promised to be a long, boring, and predictable speech. Instead of returning to the whip's office, which afforded no privacy, Charles disappeared into one of the telephone booths near the cloisters above the members' cloakroom. He checked the number and dialed it.
"Alexander, it's Charles. Charles Seymour."
"Good to hear from you, Charles. It's been a long time. How are you?"
Well, and you?"
"Can't complain. What can I do for a busy man like you?"
"Wanted to chew over the new Sussex constituency with you. Little Hampton, how's your selection of a candidate going?"
"They've left me to draw up a short list of 6 for final selection by the full committee in about 10 days' time."
"Have you thought of standing yourself, Alexander?"
"Many times," came back the reply. "But the old lady wouldn't allow it. Neither would the bank balance. Do you have any ideas?"
"Might be able to help. Why don't you come and have a quiet dinner at my place early next week?
Well, that's kind of you, Charles.
Not at all. It'll be good to see you again. It's been far too long. Next Monday, suit you?
Absolutely.
Good. Let's say 8 o'clock, 27 Eden Square. Charles put the phone down, returned to the whip's office, and penciled a note in his diary. Raymond had just finished making his contribution to the European debate when Charles returned to take a seat on the half-empty Treasury bench. Raymond had made a coherent economic case for remaining free of the other six European countries and for building stronger links with the Commonwealth and America. He doubted that Britain could take the financial burden of entering a club that had been in existence for so long. If the country had joined at its inception, it might have been different, he argued. But he would have to vote against this risky, unproven venture that he suspected could only lead to higher unemployment. When Raymond sat down, he did not receive the acclamation that Andrew had, and worse, what praise he did elicit came from the left wing of the party, who had spent so much time in the past criticising full employment at any cost. Charles put a cross by the name Gould. A note was being passed along the row to Raymond from one of the house badge messengers, dressed in white tie and black tails. It read, "Please ring head of chambers as soon as convenient." Raymond left the floor of the house and went to the nearest telephone in the corner of the members' lobby. He was immediately put through to Sir Nigel Hartwell. "You wanted me to phone?"
"Yes," said Sir Nigel. "Are you free at the moment?"
"I am," said Raymond. "Why, is it something urgent?"
"I'd rather not talk about it over the phone," said Sir Nigel ominously.
Raymond took a tube from Westminster to Temple and was in chambers 15 minutes later. He went straight to Sir Nigel's office, sat down in the comfortable chair in the corner of the spacious club-like room, crossed his legs, and watched Sir Nigel pace about in front of him. He was clearly determined to get something off his chest.
"Raymond, I've been asked by those in authority about you taking silk. I've said I think you'd make a damn good QC.
A smile came over Raymond's face, but it was soon wiped off.
"But I need an undertaking from you."
"An undertaking?"
"Yes," said Sir Nigel. "You must stop having this damn silly relationship with another member of chambers."
He rounded on Raymond and faced him. Raymond turned scarlet, but before he could speak, the head of chambers continued.
"Now, I want your word on it," said Sir Nigel, "that it will end, and end immediately."
"You have my word," said Raymond quietly.
"I'm not a prig," said Sir Nigel, pulling down on his waistcoat. "But if you're going to have an affair, for God's sake, make it as far away from the office as possible. And if I may advise you, that should include the House of Commons and Leeds. There's still a lot of the world left over, and it's full of women."
Raymond nodded his agreement. He could not fault the head of chambers' logic. Sir Nigel continued, obviously embarrassed.
"There's a nasty fraud case starting in Manchester next Monday. Our client has been accused of setting up a series of companies that specialise in life insurance, but avoid paying out on the claims. I expect you remember all the publicity. Miss Arnold has been put on the case as a reserve junior. They tell me it could last several weeks."
"She'll try and get out of it," said Raymond glumly.
"She already has. But I made it quite clear that if she felt unable to take the case on, she would have to find other chambers."
Raymond breathed a sigh of relief. "Thank you," he said.
"Sorry about this. I know you've earned your silk, old boy, but I can't have members of chambers going round with egg on their faces. Thank you for your cooperation. I can't pretend I enjoyed that."
"Got time for a quiet word?" asked Charles. "You're wasting your time, dear thing, if you imagine the disciples will change their minds at this late stage," said Alec Pimpkin. all 12 of them will vote against the government on Europe. That's final.
I don't want to discuss Europe this time, Alec. It's far more serious and on a personal level. Let's go and have a drink on the terrace.
Charles ordered the drinks, and the two men strolled out to the quiet end of the terrace towards the speaker's house. Charles stopped as soon as he was certain there was no longer anyone within earshot.
"If it's not Europe, what is it?"
asked Pimpkin, staring out at the Thames.
"What's this I hear about you losing your seat?"
Pimpkin turned pale and touched his bow tie nervously.
"It's his bloody boundary business. My constituency is swallowed up. No one seems willing to interview me for a new one."
"What's it worth if I secure you a safe seat for the rest of your life?"
Pimpkin looked suspiciously up at Charles.
"Almost anything, up to a pound of flesh,"
he added with a false laugh.
"No, I won't need to cut that deep."
The colour returned to Pimpkin's cheeks.
"Whatever it is, you can rely on me, old fellow."
"Can you deliver the disciples?" said Charles.
Pimpkin turned pale again.
"Not on the small votes in committee," said Charles before Pimpkin could reply. "Not on the clauses, even. Just on the second reading, the principle itself. Standing by the party in their hour of need. No desire to cause an unnecessary general election, all that stuff. You fill in the details for the disciples. I know you can convince them, Alec."
Pimpkin still didn't speak.
"I deliver a copper-bottom seat. You deliver 12 votes. I think we can call that a fair exchange."
"What if I get them to abstain?" said Pimpkin.
Charles waited, as if giving the idea considerable thought.
"It's a deal," he said, never having hoped for anything more.
Alexander Dalgleish arrived at Eaton Square a little after 8. Fiona met him at the door and explained that Charles had not yet returned from the Commons.
"But I expect him any moment," she added. "May I offer you a drink?"
Another 30 minutes passed before Charles hurried in.
"Sorry I'm late, Alexander," he said, grasping his guest by the hand.
"I hoped I might make it just before you."
He kissed his wife on the forehead.
"Not at all," said Alexander. "I couldn't have asked for more pleasant company."
"What will you have, darling?" asked Fiona.
"A strong whiskey, please. And can we go straight into dinner? I've got to be back at the talk shop by 10.
Charles guided his guest towards the dining room and seated him at the side of the table, before taking his place below the Holbein portrait of the first Earl of Bridgewater, an heirloom his grandfather had left him. Fiona took a seat opposite her husband. During the meal of beef Wellington, Charles spent a great deal of time catching up on what Alexander had been doing since they'd last met. Although they had spent 3 years together in the Guards as brother officers, they rarely saw each other outside of regimental reunions since Charles had entered the house. He made no mention of the real purpose behind the meeting until Fiona provided the opportunity when she served coffee.
"I know you two have a lot to talk about, so I'll leave you to get on with it."
"Thank you," said Alexander.
He looked up at Fiona and smiled.
"For a lovely dinner."
She smiled back and left them alone.
"Now, Charles,"
said Alexander, picking up the file he had left on the floor by his side,
"I need to pick your brains."
"Go ahead, old fellow," said Charles, only too delighted to be of assistance.
"Sir Edward Mountjoy has sent me a pretty long list for us to consider. Among them, a Home Office Minister and one or two other Members of Parliament will be losing their present seats. What do you think of..."
Dalgleish opened the file in front of him as Charles poured him a generous glass of port and offered him a cigar from the gold case that he picked up from the sideboard.
"What a magnificent object,"
said Alexander, staring in awe at the crested box and the engraved CGS along its top.
"A family heirloom," said Charles. should have been left to my brother Rupert, but I was lucky enough to have the same initials as my grandfather. Alexander handed it back to his host before returning to his notes. "Here's a man who impresses me," he said at last. "Karslake. Simon Karslake." Charles remained silent. "You don't have an opinion, Charles?"
"Yes."
"So, what do you think of Karslake?"
"Strictly off the record."
Dalgleish nodded, but said nothing. Charles sipped his port.
"Very good," he said. "Karslake?"
"No, the port. Taylor's 35. I'm afraid Karslake is not the same vintage."
"Need I say more?"
"Well, no, I follow your drift, but it's most disappointing. He looks so good on paper."
"On paper is one thing," said Charles, "but having him as your member for 20 years is quite another. You want a man you can rely on, and his wife, never seen in the constituency, you know." He frowned.
I'm afraid I've gone too far."
"No, no," said Alexander. "I've got the picture. Next one is Norman Lamont.
First class, but he has already been selected for Kingston, I'm afraid," said Charles. Dalgleish looked down at his file once again.
"Well, what about Pimkin?"
"We were at Eton together. His looks are against him, as my grandmother used to say, but he's a sound man, and very good in the constituency, so they tell me."
"You would recommend him, then?"
"I should snap him up before another constituency adopts him."
"That popular, is he?" said Alexander. "Thanks for the tip. Pity about Karslake."
"That was strictly off the record," said Charles.
"Oh, of course. Not a word. You can rely on me."
"Cigar to your liking?"
"Excellent," said Alexander. "But your judgment has always been so good. You only have to look at Fiona to realize that."
Charles smiled. Most of the other names Dalgleish produced were either unknown, unsuitable, or easy to dismiss. When Alexander left shortly before 10, Fiona asked him if the chat had been worthwhile.
"Yes, I think we found the right man."
Raymond had the locks on his flat changed that afternoon. It turned out to be more expensive than he'd bargained for, and the carpenter had insisted on cash in advance. The carpenter grinned as he pocketed the money.
"I make a fortune doing this job, Governor, I can tell you. At least one gentleman a day. Always cash, no receipt. Means the wife and I can spend a month in Ibiza every year, tax-free."
Raymond smiled at the thought. He checked his watch. He could just catch the Thursday 7:10 from King's Cross and be in Leeds by 10 o'clock for a long weekend. Alexander Dalgleish phoned Charles a week later to tell him Pimkin had made the shortlist and that they hadn't considered Karslake.
"Pimkin didn't go over very well with the committee at the first interview."
"And no, he wouldn't," said Charles. "I warned you his looks were agin him, and he may come over a bit right-wing at times, but he's sound as a bell and will never let you down. Take my word."
"I'll have to, Charles, because by getting rid of Karslake, we removed the only real challenger."
Charles put the phone down and dialed the Home Office.
"Simon Karslake, please."
"Who's calling?"
"Seymour, Whip's office."
He was put straight through.
"Simon, it's Charles. I thought I ought to give you an update on Littlehampton."
"That's thoughtful of you," said Simon.
"Not good news, I'm afraid. It turns out the chairman wants the seat for himself. He's making sure the committee only interviews idiots."
"How can you be so certain?"
"I've seen the shortlist, and Pimkin's the only sitting member they're considering."
"I can't believe it."
"No, I was pretty shocked myself. I pressed the case for you, but it fell on deaf ears. Didn't care for your views on hanging, or some such words. Still, I can't believe you'll find it hard to pick up a seat."
"I hope you're right, Charles. But in any case, thanks for trying."
"Any time. Let me know of any other seats you put your name in for. I have a lot of friends up and down the country." Thank you, Charles. Can you pair me for next Thursday?
2 days later, Alec Pimpkin was invited by the Littlehampton Conservatives to attend a shortlist interview for the selection of a Tory candidate for the new constituency.
"How do I begin to thank you?" he asked Charles when they met in the bar.
"Keep your word, and I want it in writing," replied Charles.
"What do you mean?"
"A letter to the Chief Whip saying you've changed your mind on the main European vote, and you and the disciples will be abstaining on Thursday."
Pimpkin looked cocky. "And if I don't play ball, dear thing?"
"You haven't got the seat yet, Alec, and I might find it necessary to phone Alexander Dalglish and tell him about that awfully nice little boy you made such a fool of yourself over when you were at Oxford." 3 days later, the Chief Whip received the letter from Pimpkin. He immediately summoned his junior whip.
"Well done, Charles. How did you manage to succeed where we all failed? And the disciples as well?"
"Matter of loyalty," said Charles.
"Pimpkin saw that, in the end."
On the final day of the great debate on the principle of entry into Europe, the Prime Minister delivered the winding-up speech. He rose at 9:30 to cheers from both sides. At 10 o'clock, the House divided and voted in favour of the principle by a majority of 112. 69 Labour MPs, led by Roy Jenkins, had helped to swell the government's majority. Raymond Gould voted against the motion in accordance with his long-held beliefs. Andrew Fraser joined Simon Carslake and Charles Seymour in the Ayes lobby. Alec Pimpkin and the 12 disciples remained in their places on the Commons benches while the vote took place. When Charles heard the Speaker read out the final result, he felt a moment of triumph, although he realised that he still had the committee stage to go through. Hundreds of clauses, any of which could go wrong and turn the bill into a farce. Nevertheless, the first round belonged to him. 10 days later, Alec Pimpkin defeated a keen young Conservative just down from Cambridge and a local woman councillor to be selected as prospective candidate for Littlehampton. Chapter 14. Andrew studied the case once again and decided to make his own inquiries. Too many constituents had, in the past, demonstrated that they were willing to lie to him in surgery as happily as they would in the witness box to any judge. Robert was trying to climb up onto his lap. Andrew hoisted him the remainder of the way in one tug and attempted to return to his papers. "Whose side are you on?" Andrew demanded, as his son dribbled all over his freshly written notes. He stopped to pat his bottom. "Ah," he said, putting the case file by his side on the floor. A few minutes later, Robert had been changed and left with his mother. "I'm afraid your son is not over-anxious to help me in my desire to secure the release of an innocent man," Andrew shouted over his shoulder. He settled down to go over the papers once more. Something about the case didn't ring true. Andrew dialed the Procurator Fiscal's number. There was one man who could cut his work in half with a sentence.
"Good morning, Mr. Fraser. What can I do for you, sir?"
Andrew had to smile. Angus Sinclair was a contemporary of his father and had known Andrew all his life, but once he was in his office, he treated everyone as a stranger, making no exception.
"He even calls his wife Mrs. Sinclair when she rings the office," Sir Duncan once told him.
Andrew was willing to join in the game.
"Good morning, Mr. Sinclair. I need your advice as Procurator Fiscal."
"Always happy to be of service, sir."
"I want to talk to you off the record about the Paddy O'Halloran case. Do you remember it?"
"Of course. Everyone in this office remembers that case."
"Good," said Andrew. "Then you'll know what a help you can be to me in cutting through the thicket."
"Thank you, sir."
The slight burr came back down the telephone.
"A group of my constituents, whom I wouldn't trust further than I could toss a caber, claim O'Halloran was framed for the Princes Street bank robbery last year. They don't deny he has criminal tendencies. Andrew would have chuckled if he hadn't been speaking to Angus Sinclair. But they say he never left a pub called the Sir Walter Scott the entire time the robbery was taking place. All you have to tell me, Mr. Sinclair, is that you have no doubt that O'Halloran was guilty, and I'll drop my inquiries. If you say nothing, I shall dig deeper. Andrew waited, but he received no reply. Thank you, Mr. Sinclair. Although he knew it would elicit no response, he couldn't resist adding, No doubt I'll see you at the golf club sometime over the weekend. The silence continued. Goodbye, Mr. Sinclair.
Good day, Mr. Fraser.
Andrew settled back. It was going to be a lengthy exercise. He started by checking with all the people who had confirmed O'Halloran's alibi that night, but after interviewing the first eight, he came to the reluctant conclusion that none of them could be trusted as a witness. Whenever he came across another of O'Halloran's friends, the expression, "Anyone's for a pint," kept crossing his mind. The time had come to talk with the landlord of the Sir Walter Scott.
I couldn't be sure, Mr. Fraser, but I think he was here that evening. Trouble is, O'Halloran came almost every night. It's hard to recall.
Do you know anyone who might remember? Someone you could trust with your cash register?
That'll be pushing your luck in this pub, Mr. Fraser.
The landlord thought for a moment.
However, there's old Mrs. Bloxham,
he said at last, slapping the drying-up cloth over his shoulder.
She sits in that corner every night.
He pointed to a small round table that would have been crowded had it seated more than two people.
If she says it was here, it was.
Andrew asked the landlord where Mrs. Bloxham lived, and then, hoping she was in, made his way to 43 Mafeking Road, neatly sidestepping a gang of young children playing football in the middle of the street. He climbed some steps that badly needed repairing and knocked on the door of number 43.
Is it another general election already, Mr. Fraser?
Asked a disbelieving old lady as she peered through the letterbox.
No, it's nothing to do with politics, Mrs. Bloxham, said Andrew, bending down. I came round to seek your advice on a personal matter.
A personal matter? Better come on in out of the cold, then,
she said, opening the door to him.
There's a terrible draught rushes through this corridor.
Andrew followed the old lady as she shuffled down the dingy corridor in her carpet slippers to a room that he would have said was colder than it had been outside on the street. There were no ornaments in the room, save a crucifix that stood on a narrow mantelpiece below a pastel print of the Virgin Mary. Mrs. Bloxham beckoned Andrew to a wooden seat by a table yet unlaid. She eased her plump frame into an ancient stuffed armchair. It groaned under her weight, and a strand of horsehair fell to the floor. Andrew looked more carefully at the old lady. She was wearing a black shawl over a dress that she must have worn 1,000 times. Once settled in her chair, she kicked off her slippers.
"Feet still giving you trouble, then?" he inquired.
"Doctor doesn't seem to be able to explain the swellings," she said, without bitterness.
Andrew leaned on the table and noticed what a fine piece of furniture it was, and how incongruous it looked in its present surroundings. He was struck by the craftsmanship of the carved Georgian legs. She noticed he was admiring it.
"My great-grandfather gave that to my great-grandmother the day they were married, Mr. Fraser."
"It's magnificent," said Andrew.
She didn't seem to hear, because all she said was,
"What can I do for you, sir?"
The second time that day he had been addressed by an elder in that way. Andrew went over the O'Halloran story again. Mrs. Bloxham listened intently, leaning forward slightly and cupping her hand round her ear to make sure she could hear every word.
"That O'Halloran is an evil one," she said. "Not to be trusted. Our Blessed Lady will have to be very forgiving to allow the likes of him to enter the kingdom of heaven."
Andrew smiled.
"Not that I'm expecting to meet all that many politicians when I get there, either,"
she added, giving Andrew a toothless grin.
"Could O'Halloran possibly have been there that Friday night, as all his friends claim?" Andrew asked.
"'He was there, all right,' said Mrs. Bloxham. "'No doubt about that. "'Saw him with my own eyes.'
"'How can you be so sure?'
"'Spilt his beer over my best dress, "'and I knew something bad would happen on the 13th, "'especially with it being Friday. "'I won't forgive him for that. "'I still haven't been able to get the stain out, "'despite what those washing powder ads tell you on the telly.'
"'Why didn't you inform the police immediately?'
"'Didn't ask,' she said simply. "'They've been after him for a long time "'for a lot of things they couldn't pin on him, "'but for once he was in the clear.'
"'Andrew finished writing his notes "'and then rose to leave. "'Mrs. Bloxham heaved herself out of the chair, "'dispensing yet more horsehair onto the floor. "'They walked to the door together.
"'I'm sorry I couldn't offer you a cup of tea, "'but I'm right out at the moment,' she said. "'If you'd come tomorrow, it would have been all right.'
"'Andrew paused on the doorstep.
"'I get the pension tomorrow, you see,'
she replied to his unasked question. "'It took Elizabeth some time to find a locum to cover for her "'so that she could travel to Redcorn for the interview. "'Once again, the children had to be left with a babysitter. "'The local and national press had made him the hot favourite for the new seat.' Elizabeth put on what she called her best conservative outfit, a pale blue suit with dark blue collar that hid everything on top, and reached well below her knees. The journey from King's Cross to Newcastle took 3 hours and 20 minutes, on what was described in the timetable as the Express. At least Simon was able to catch up with a great deal of the paperwork that had been stuffed into his red box. Civil servants, he reflected, rarely allowed politicians time to involve themselves in politics. They wouldn't have been pleased to learn that he spent an hour of the journey reading the last 4 weekly copies of the Redcorn News. At Newcastle, they were met by the wife of the Association Treasurer, who had volunteered to escort the Minister and Mrs. Carslake to the constituency to be sure they were in time for the interview. "'That's very thoughtful of you,' said Elizabeth, as she stared at the mode of transport that had been chosen to take them the next 40 miles. The ancient Austin Mini took a further 1.5 hours through the winding B-roads before they reached their destination, and the treasurer's wife never drew breath once throughout the entire journey. When Simon and Elizabeth piled out of the car at the market town of Redcorn, they were physically and mentally exhausted. The treasurer's wife took them through the constituency headquarters and introduced them both to the agent.
"'Good of you to come,' he said. "'Hell of a journey, isn't it?'
Elizabeth felt unable to disagree with his judgment, but on this occasion she made no comment, feeling that if this was to be Simon's best chance of returning to Parliament, she had already decided to give him every support possible. Nevertheless, she dreaded the thought of her husband making the journey to Redcorn twice a month, as she feared they would see even less of each other than they did at present, let alone the children.
"'Now, the form is,' began the agent, "'that we're interviewing 6 potential candidates, and they'll be seeing you last.'
He winked knowingly. Simon and Elizabeth smiled uncertainly.
"'I'm afraid they won't be ready for you for at least another hour, so you have time to stroll round the town.'
Simon was glad of the chance to stretch his legs, and take a closer look at Redcorn. He and Elizabeth walked slowly round the pretty market town, admiring the Elizabethan architecture that had somehow survived irresponsible or greedy town planners. They even climbed a hill to take a look inside the magnificent perpendicular church which dominated the surrounding area. As he walked back past the shops in the high street, Simon nodded to those locals who appeared to recognise him.
"'A lot of people seem to know who you are,' said Elizabeth.
And then they saw the paper rack outside the local newsagent. They sat on the bench in the market square and read the lead story under a large picture of Simon. "'Redcorn's next MP?' ran the headline. The story volunteered the fact that although Simon Carslake had to be considered the favourite, Bill Travers, a local farmer who had been chairman of the county council the previous year, was still thought to have an outside chance. Simon began to feel a little sick in the stomach. It reminded him of the day he'd been interviewed at Coventry Central nearly 8 years before. Now that he was a minister of the Crown, he wasn't any less nervous. When he and Elizabeth returned to constituency headquarters, they were informed that only two more candidates had been seen, and the third was still being interviewed. They walked around the town once again, even more slowly this time, watching the shopkeepers put up their coloured shutters and turn open signs to closed. "What a pleasant market town," said Simon, trying to find out how his wife was feeling. "And the people seem so polite after London," she added. Simon smiled as they headed back to the party headquarters. As they passed Simon and Elizabeth, they bid the strangers good evening, courteous people whom Simon felt he would have been proud to represent. But although they walked slowly, Elizabeth and he could not make their journey last more than 30 minutes. When they returned a third time to constituency headquarters, the fourth candidate was leaving the interview room. She looked very despondent. "It shouldn't be long now," said the agent. But it was another 40 minutes before they heard a ripple of applause, and a man dressed in a Harris tweed jacket and brown trousers left the room. He didn't seem happy either. The agent ushered Simon and Elizabeth through, and as they entered, everyone in the room stood. Ministers of the Crown did not visit Redcorn often. Simon waited for Elizabeth to be seated before he took the chair in the centre of the room, facing the committee. He estimated that there were about 50 people present, and they were all staring at him, showing no aggression, merely curiosity. He looked around at the weather-beaten faces. Most of them, male and female, were dressed in tweed. In his dark-striped London suit, Simon felt out of place. "And now," said the chairman, "we welcome the Right Honourable Simon Carslake, MP." Simon had to smile at the mistake so many people made in thinking that all ministers were automatically members of the Privy Council and therefore entitled to the prefix Right Honourable instead of the plain Honourable, accorded to all MPs, and then only when they were present in the House. "Mr. Carslake will address us for 20 minutes, and he's kindly agreed to answer questions after that," added the chairman. Simon felt confident he had spoken well, but even his few carefully chosen quips received no more than a smile, and his more serious comments elicited little response. This was not a group of people given to showing their emotions. When he'd finished, he sat down to respectful clapping and murmurs. "Now the minister will take questions," said the chairman. "Where do you stand on hanging?" said a scowling middle-aged woman in a grey suit seated in the front row. Simon explained his reasons for being a convinced abolitionist. The scowl did not move from the questioner's face, and Simon thought to himself how much happier she would be with Ronnie Nethercott as her member. A man in a hacking jacket asked, "How do you feel, Mr. Carslake, about this year's farm subsidy?" "Good on eggs, tough on beef, and disastrous for pig farmers. Or at least that's what I read on the front page of Farmers Weekly yesterday." Some of them laughed for the first time. "It hasn't proved necessary for me to have a great knowledge of farming in Coventry Central, but if I'm lucky enough to be selected for Redcorn, I shall try to learn quickly, and with your help I shall hope to master the farmers' problems." Several heads nodded their approval. "Miss Pentecost, chairman of the Women's Advisory," announced a tall, thin, spinsterish woman who had stood up to catch the chairman's eye. "May I be permitted to ask Mrs. Carslake a question? If your husband were offered this seat, would you be willing to come and live in Northumberland?" Elizabeth had dreaded the question, because she knew that if Simon was offered the constituency, she would be expected to resign her post at the hospital. Simon turned and looked towards his wife. "No," she replied directly. "I'm a doctor at St. Mary's Hospital, Paddington, where I practice gynaecology. I support my husband in his career, but, like Margaret Thatcher, I believe a woman has the right to a good education, and then the chance to use her qualifications to their best advantage." A ripple of applause went round the room, and Simon smiled at his wife. The next question was on Europe, and Simon gave an unequivocal statement as to his reasons for backing the Prime Minister in his desire to see Britain as part of the common market. Simon continued to answer questions on subjects ranging from trade union reform to violence on television, before the chairman asked, "Are there any more questions?" There was a long silence, and just as he was about to thank Simon, the scowling lady in the front row, without being recognised by the chair, asked what Mr. Karslake's views were on abortion. "Morally, I'm against it," said Simon. "At the time of the Abortion Act, many of us believed it would stem the tide of divorce. We've been proved wrong. The rate of divorce has quadrupled. Nevertheless, in the cases of rape or fear of physical or mental injury arising from birth, I would have to support the medical advice given at the time. Elizabeth and I have two children, and my wife's job is to see that babies are safely delivered," he added. The lips moved from a scowl to a straight line. "Thank you," said the chairman. "It was good of you to give us so much of your time. Perhaps you and Mrs. Karslake would be kind enough to wait outside." Simon and Elizabeth joined the other hopeful candidates, their wives and the agent, in a small dingy room at the back of the building. When they saw the half-empty trestle table in front of them, they both remembered that they hadn't had lunch, and devoured what was left of the curling cucumber sandwiches and the cold sausage rolls. "What happens next?" Simon asked the agent between mouthfuls.
"Nothing out of the ordinary. They'll have a discussion, allowing everyone to express their views, and then vote. It should all be over in 20 minutes.
Elizabeth checked her watch. It was 7 o'clock, and the last train was at 9:15. "Ought to make the train comfortably," said Simon. An hour later, when no smoke had emerged from the chimney, the agent suggested to all the candidates, who had a long journey ahead of them, that they might like to check into the Bell Inn just over the road. When Simon looked around the room, it was clear that everyone else had done so in advance.
"You'd better stay put in case you're called again," Elizabeth said. "I'll go off and book a room, and at the same time call and see how the children are getting on."
"Probably eaten the poor babysitter by now," said Simon.
Elizabeth smiled before slipping out and making her way to the small hotel. Simon opened his red box and tried to complete some work. The man, who looked like a farmer, came over and introduced himself.
"I'm Bill Travers, the chairman of the new constituency," he began. "I only wanted to say that you'll have my full support as chairman if the committee select you."
"Thank you," said Simon.
"I had hoped to represent this area as my grandfather did, but I shall understand if Redcorn prefers to choose a man destined for the cabinet rather than someone who would be happy to spend his life on the back benches."
Simon was touched by his opponent's goodwill and would have liked to respond in kind, but Travers quickly added,
"Forgive me, I'll not waste any more of your time. I can see,"
he looked down at the red box,
"that you have a lot of work to catch up on."
Simon felt guilty as he watched the man walk away. A few minutes later, Elizabeth returned and tried to smile. "The only room left is smaller than Peter's, and it faces the main road, so it's just about as noisy." "At least no children to say I'm hungry," he said, touching her hand. It was a little after 9 when a weary chairman came out and asked all the candidates if he could have their attention. Husbands and wives all faced him.
"My committee want to thank you for going through this grim procedure. It's been hard for us to decide something that we hope not to have to discuss again for 20 years.
He paused.
"The committee are going to invite Mr. Bill Travers to fight the Redcorn seat at the next election."
In a sentence, it was all over. Simon's throat went dry. He and Elizabeth didn't get much sleep in their tiny room at the Bell Inn, and it hadn't helped that the agent told them the final vote had been 25-23.
"I don't think Miss Pentecost liked me," said Elizabeth, feeling guilty. "If I'd told her that I would have been willing to live in the constituency, I think you'd have been offered the seat."
"I doubt it," said Simon. "In any case, it's no use agreeing to their terms at the interview, and then imposing your own when you've been offered the constituency. My guess is you'll find Redcorn has chosen the right man." Elizabeth smiled at her husband, grateful for his support. There'll be other seats, said Simon, only too aware that time was now running out. You'll see. Elizabeth prayed that he would prove right, and that next time the choice of a constituency would not make her have to face the dilemma she had so far managed to avoid.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 4 of First Among Equals. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 5. First Among Equals, Cassette 5.
When Raymond took silk the second Tuesday after the Easter holiday and became a Queen's Counsel, Joyce made one of her periodic trips to London. The occasion, she decided, warranted another visit to Harvey Nichols. She recalled her first trip to the store so many years before, when she had accompanied her husband to meet the Prime Minister. Raymond had come so far since then, although their relationship seemed to have progressed so little. She had given up hope of being a mother, but she still wanted him to believe that she was a good wife. She couldn't help thinking how much better-looking Raymond had become in middle age, and feared the same could not be said of her. She enjoyed watching the legal ceremony as her husband was presented in court before the judges, Latin words spoken but not understood. Suddenly, her husband was Raymond Gould, QC, MP. She and Raymond arrived late in chambers for the celebration party. Everyone seemed to have turned out in her husband's honour. Raymond felt full of bonhomie and was chatting to the chief clerk when Sir Nigel handed him a glass of champagne. Then he saw a familiar figure by the mantelpiece and remembered that the trial in Manchester was over. He managed to circle the room, speaking to everyone but Stephanie Arnold. To his horror, he turned to see her introducing herself to his wife.
"Ladies and gentlemen," said Sir Nigel, banging a table.
He waited for silence.
"We're always proud in chambers when one of our members takes silk. It is a comment not only on the man, but also on his chambers. And when it is the youngest silk, still under 40, it adds to that pride. All of you, of course, know that Raymond also serves in another place, in which we expect him to rise to even greater glory. May I add, finally, how pleasant it is to have his wife Joyce among us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen," he concluded, "the toast is Raymond Gould, QC." "Raymond Gould, QC," said everyone in chorus. Then, "Speech, speech."
"I would like to thank all those people who made this great honour possible," began Raymond. "My producer, my director, the other stars, and not forgetting the criminals, without whom I would have no profession to profess. And finally," he said, "to those of you who want to see the back of me, I direct you all to work tirelessly to ensure the return of a Labour government at the next election. Thank you."
The applause was sustained and genuine, and many of his colleagues were impressed by how relaxed Raymond had become of late. As they came up to congratulate him, Raymond couldn't help noticing that Stephanie and Joyce had resumed their conversation. Raymond was handed another glass of champagne, just as an earnest young pupil called Patrick Montague, who had recently joined them from chambers in Bristol, engaged him in conversation. Although Montague had been with them for some weeks, Raymond had never spoken to him at length before. He seemed to have very clear views on criminal law and the changes that were necessary. For the first time in his life, Raymond felt he was no longer a young man. Suddenly, both women were at his side. "Hello, Raymond."
"Hello, Stephanie,"
he said awkwardly, and looked anxiously towards his wife. "Do you know Patrick Montague?" he asked, absent-mindedly. The three of them burst out laughing.
"What's so funny?" asked Raymond.
"You do embarrass me sometimes, Raymond," said Joyce. "Surely you realise Stephanie and Patrick are engaged?"
Chapter 15.
"With or without civil servants?" asked Simon, as Andrew entered the minister's office.
"Without, please."
"Fine," said Simon, and pressed a switch on the intercom by his desk. "I don't want to be disturbed while I'm with Mr. Fraser," he said, and ushered his colleague towards a comfortable seat in the corner. Elizabeth was asking me this morning to find out how Robert's getting on.
"It's his second birthday next month, and he's overweight for a scrum half," replied Andrew.
"And how's your search for a seat working out?"
"Not too good. The last three constituencies to come up haven't even asked to see me. I can't put a finger on why, except they seem all to have selected local men."
"It's a long time to the next election. You're sure to find a seat before then."
"It might not be so long if the Prime Minister decides to go to the country and test his strength against the unions."
"That would be a foolish thing to do," said Andrew. "He might defeat us, but he still wouldn't defeat the unions."
A young woman came into the room with two cups of coffee, put them on a low formica table, and left the two men alone.
"Have you had time to look at the file?" Andrew continued.
"Yes, I went over it last night between checking over Peter's prep and helping Michael to build a model galleon."
"And how do you feel?" Andrew asked.
"Not very good. I can't get to grips with this new maths they're now teaching, and my mast was the only one that fell off when Elizabeth launched the galleon in the bath."
Andrew laughed.
"I think you've got a case," said Simon, sounding serious.
"Good," said Andrew. "Now, the reason I wanted to see you privately is because I feel there are no party political points to be made out of this case for either of us. I've no plans to try to embarrass your department, and I consider it's in the best interest of my constituents to cooperate as closely as I can with you."
"Thank you," said Simon.
"So, where do you want to go from here?"
"I'd like to table a planted question for your department in the hope that you would consider opening an inquiry. If the inquiry comes to the same conclusion as I have, I would expect you to order a retrial."
Simon hesitated.
"And if the inquiry goes against you, will you agree to no reprisals for the Home Office?"
"Do you have my word on it?"
"Shall I ask the civil servants to come in now?"
"Yes, please do."
Simon returned to his desk and pressed a button. A moment later, three men in almost identical suits, white shirts with stiff collars and discreet ties, entered the room. Between them, they could have ruined any police identification parade.
"Mr. Fraser," began Simon, "is asking the Home Office to consider..."
"Can you explain why Simon Carslake missed a vote yesterday?"
Charles looked across the table at the Chief Whip.
"No, I can't," he said. "I've been distributing the weekly whip to him the same as every member of my group."
"What's behind it, then?"
"I think the poor man has been spending a lot of his time traipsing around the country looking for a seat to fight at the next election."
"Well, that's no excuse," said the Chief Whip. "Duties in the House must come first. Every member knows that. He missed a vote on a vital clause during the European Bill last Thursday, while everyone else in your group has proved reliable. Despite our majority, we seem to be in single figures for almost every clause. Perhaps I should have a word with him."
No, I'd rather you didn't," said Charles, fearing he sounded a little too insistent.
"I consider it my responsibility. I'll speak to him and see that it doesn't happen again."
"All right, Charles, if that's the way you want to play it. Thank God it can't last much longer, and the damn thing will soon be law. But we must remain vigilant over every clause. The Labour Party know only too well that if they defeat us on certain key clauses, they can still scupper the whole bill. And if I lost one of those by a single vote, I'd cut Carslake's throat, or anyone else's who was responsible."
"I'll make sure he gets the message," said Charles.
"How's Fiona reacting to all these late nights?"
the Chief Whip asked, finally relaxing.
"Very well, considering. In fact, now that you mention it, I've never seen her looking better."
"Can't say my wife is enjoying the
prep school antics, as she describes our continual late-night sittings. I've had to promise to take her to the West Indies this winter to make up for it. Well, I'll leave you to deal with Karslake, then. Be firm, Charles. Just remember, we can't afford to lose a vote at this late stage.
Norman Edwards, repeated Raymond in disbelief. The General Secretary of the Haulage Union.
Yes, said Fred Paget, getting up from behind his desk.
But he burned full employment at any cost on a public bonfire with every journalist he could lay his hands on to witness the conflagration.
I know, said Fred, returning a letter to the filing cabinet. I'm only your agent. I'm not here to explain the mysteries of the universe.
When does he want to see me? Asked Raymond.
As soon as possible.
Better ask him if he can come for a drink back at the house around 6 o'clock. Raymond had had a heavy Saturday morning surgery, and thanks to the still imminent Martians, had only found time to grab a sandwich at the pub before going off to pursue his favourite pastime. This week, Leeds were playing Liverpool at Elland Road. Sitting in the director's box every other week in full view of his constituents, while he supported his local football team, killed 30,000 birds with one stone. Later, when talking to the lads in the dressing room after the match, he found himself lapsing into a pronounced Yorkshire accent that bore no resemblance to the one he used to address High Court judges during the week. Leeds won 3-2, and after the match, Raymond joined the directors for a drink in the boardroom. He became so impassioned about an offside decision that could have lost them a point that he nearly forgot about his meeting with Norman Edwards. Joyce was in the garden showing the union leader her early snowdrops when Raymond returned.
"Sorry I'm late," he shouted as he hung up his yellow and blue scarf. "I've been to the match."
"Who won?" asked Edwards.
"Leeds, of course. 3-2.
"Damn," said Norman, his accent leaving the other in no doubt that he had not spent many nights outside of Liverpool.
"Come on in and have a beer," said Raymond.
"I'd prefer a vodka."
The two men went into the house, while Joyce continued with her gardening.
"Well," said Raymond, pouring his guest a Smirnoff, "what brings you all the way from Liverpool, if it wasn't to watch the football? Perhaps you wanted a signed copy of my book for your next union bonfire."
"Don't give me any hassle, Ray. I came all this way because I need your help. Simple as that."
"I'm all ears," said Raymond.
"We had a full meeting of the General Purposes Committee yesterday, and one of the brothers has spotted a clause in the European bill which could put us all out of work."
Norman passed over a copy of the bill to Raymond with the relevant clause marked in red. It gave the minister power to make new haulage and lorry regulations which would come before the House as statutory instruments and thus could not be amended.
"If that gets through the House, my boys are in deep trouble."
"Why?" said Raymond.
"Because those bloody frogs know only too well that there's a channel between us and them, and if my lads are forced by law to sleep a night each side, the only people who'll end up making money on the deal will be the guest house proprietors."
"What's behind it?" asked Raymond.
"They want us to drop the stuff our end, so they can pick it up on the other side."
"But wouldn't that also be true when they need to deliver goods to us?"
"No. Their journeys are much longer to the coast, and they have to stay overnight anyway, not to mention the fact that there's 8 of them to 1 of us. It's diabolical, nothing less."
Raymond studied the wording in detail, while Edwards helped himself to another vodka. "The clause doesn't stop you from going over the next day."
"And how much do you think that will add to your costs?" asked Raymond.
"I'll tell you. Enough to make us uncompetitive. That's how much," replied the trade union leader.
"Point taken," said Raymond. "So what's wrong with asking your own member to put the case?"
"Don't trust him. He's pro-European at any price."
"And what about your sponsored trade union representative in the House?"
"Tom Carson? You must be joking. He's so far to the left that even his own side is suspicious when he supports a cause. We lost the tachograph clause because he championed it. In any case, I only put him in the House to get him off my back."
Raymond laughed.
Now all my General Purposes Committee want to know is, would you be willing to fight this clause in the House for us? Not that we can afford the sort of fees you're used to at the bar.